This is just an amazing tribute to what one person can do when they're just determined to get a project done.
Well, I was determined, and I guess that's how I feel now that I've finished it. People ask me if I'm hopeful or not, and I have to say, perhaps not hopeful. The right word for me, I think, is determined.
Okay, and again, I'm speaking with Gary Brosh about his book, Earth Under Fire, How Global Warming is Changing the World. So there's a lot of pictures here about how the climate is changing. Where do you think the most dramatic changes are evident?
I don't think there's any doubt that the most dramatic changes are seen in the Arctic. And in terms of the United States, in Alaska, we just had a period just a little over a month ago when there was the least amount of ice on the Arctic Ocean ever measured by humans anyway. Now, that's a relatively short period, but looking back in the geologic record and what scientists know about the previous state of the Arctic Ocean, it's thought that it hasn't been such a little amount of ice on the Arctic Ocean in summer for many, many, many thousands of years. This is a really big change because that ice usually covers most of the Arctic Ocean, and ice is white and reflects a lot of solar radiation back into space. The idea that the Arctic Ocean is now being warmed directly by sunlight is a feedback loop that is likely to make warming happen even faster, according to some scientists. And this has actually caught a lot of scientists by surprise about how fast this is happening. Also in Alaska, you can see direct effects on people, the people who live along the coastlines in Alaska, mostly their natives. They're suffering severely because their habitual hunting grounds, which are now little villages, are being eroded quite rapidly, partly because of the loss of ice and also because permafrost is thawing. But this is the place where the temperature is going up very rapidly and the changes are happening faster than most scientists were willing to predict even 5 or 10 years ago.
You know, so you went out into the field and you were actually with the scientists who were doing the measurements.
Yeah, the idea of my project was following on the other work that I've been doing for magazines where I would report on what a scientist was doing or a natural history event. I just emailed scientists after I saw a published paper by them. This is all based on published work that's been in the scientific journals. And I told them what I wanted to do, and some of them knew of my work from before, and I asked them if I could come out and take photographs. And they, without exception, were very, very helpful. Sometimes I didn't have the money to go at the time when I was invited. But this allowed me to get not only to Alaska, where I saw how the scientists go out every year and count the same plot on the tundra every year and count the plants. They know exactly what's happening with the plants and can see the changes. The same thing with birds in the Northeast and in Minnesota. The same thing with alpine plants in the Alps. The same thing with rainforest plants in Costa Rica and in the rainforests of Australia. These are scientists that are dedicated enough to go out to the same place every year, year after year, take very meticulous notes and records. And over time, they see changes. And when they run their mathematical correlations, the tie to the change in temperature is extremely robust, as they say in science. It's a very strong connection with the changing temperature on the planet.
Well, I think that was one of the things that struck me, too, about this book, is that you've got so many statistics here on how it's affecting the plants and animals. But one thing, how do we know that this is human-caused?
There are a couple of clues about where this warming is coming from. First of all, there's almost no doubt that if you add carbon dioxide to our atmosphere, it creates an additional warming. Carbon dioxide molecules, they absorb heat and they re-radiate it, and that's the greenhouse effect, which is good because that's what brought the planet to its current near its current temperature that allows life to be on land. It allows ice, for example, to melt during the summer and give us fresh water. But scientists can see two things. Number one, that there's a great deal more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere now than there has been for many, many thousands of years. The current figure is 800,000 years that there's more CO2 in the air than has ever been in that period of time. And the second thing that they can measure is
Say that number again. How many years?
800,000 years is the distance into the past that they can see carbon dioxide in the ice of Antarctica.
Wow.
And there has been no point in that period of time where the level of CO2 has been higher than it is today.
800,000 years.
Yes.
That is mind-boggling.
And the second thing that they know is that the kind of carbon that comes from fossil fuels, from coal and oil, that we only started using about 150 years ago or so in earnest. Before that, there was coal for 100 years or so in Europe. When you burn that fossil fuel, it creates a carbon and a carbon dioxide that has a particular signature. It's different than the carbons coming out of our lungs as we breathe. It's different than the kind of carbon coming from the forests and coming from volcanoes and so forth. So it actually can be measured. And the increase is this old carbon from fossil fuels, and there's no other species has been burning it but humans.
Right.
And so these are very strong mathematical and chemical discoveries that most scientists agree with wholeheartedly. It's been proven to their satisfaction. There isn't much controversy over the fact that the planet is warming.
Right.
There's more controversy now over how fast it's going to happen and whether or not humans should really do anything about it or if it would be corrected naturally. But as the events like in Alaska with the extra melting are showing, that things are starting to happen more rapidly, not less rapidly.
Well, so that was one thing that struck me, too, is that we've actually got levels of the greenhouse gases that are lower now than they predicted that they would be in the early 70s. But it seems like the effects of the global warming are happening more rapidly than anybody expected, even with, you know, if we had had the higher levels.
Well, it is true that we made some changes after the great oil crisis of the 70s. When Jimmy Carter came on television in his sweater and people laughed at him, but a lot of people in business and industry took note of that. And the amount of efficiencies that we have now even in our cars, but especially in appliances, industrial processes, and so forth, is quite a success story. I mean, it tells me that we can do this again. We have actually more tools now than we had then. But so if we got scared about oil prices at that point, and we made a lot of changes in efficiency, and so yes, the amount of CO2 that we use, the intensity of the amount of CO2 that we use in the United States has decreased since the 70s, and that's good. The latest figures, however, from the last couple of years indicate that worldwide anyway, the level of CO2 is starting put out every year is starting to increase again.
And that,
because that would be bad.
Yeah, yeah, that probably has a lot to do with what's happening in places like India and China, where their economies are starting to develop rapidly.
China is quite amazing. This is a place I wanted to go. I don't think you can talk about climate change or witness climate change without going to China. I've only been there once, so this is a very tiny little slice of that huge country. But I was I made pains to try to visit some places where they get coal out of the ground. I looked at some of the places where they use coal, and I saw a factory, actually, a steel works in Beijing itself, that was polluting heavier than I've seen an American plant pollute. I mean, I went to college in Chicago when U.S. Steel was still polluting the south side of Chicago like mad. I've never seen anything like this. These are really old plants, and they use coal, and they're very inefficient. In fact, coal is China's main fuel, and they intend to use it. They're building, by estimates that I've seen, I can't confirm this myself, but the estimates are they're building a coal-fired power plant every 2 weeks or so, sometimes, and maybe even more rapidly.
Every 2 weeks?
I think, and some people say it's more rapidly than that. And there are what you might call rogue power plants. There are companies who are far away from Beijing and from the control system. It is, after all, not a democracy, that are building their own power plants and making factories that don't comply with any kind of regulations and are polluting even more. It's hard to get a figure on how bad the pollution is, but if you look around the cities and you see the smog and the haze and you learn about the illness that tens of thousands of people in China that are ill from the smoke, you see that they are really heedlessly going forward to get power any way they can. And they have just become one of the largest importers of oil. They are definitely involved in the rise in oil prices that we see this year, and they're going to continue. I think, but what I basically feel is that anything that we do in this country, if we ever get it in our heads, and with the new administration, perhaps we will, to do what we can do, the amazing changes we could make to use a lot less fossil fuels. If China's not there with us, then the climate crisis, if you want to call it that, is going to get worse. And I think there are places like in the Arctic where you see that it is getting to be a crisis, although people in the mid-latitudes where we live are really not feeling that effect as much, but it is starting to change everywhere.
Okay, and I'm speaking with Gary Brosh about his book, Earth Under Fire, How Global Warming is Changing the World. Now, you live here in Portland, right?
Yes.
And what sort of changes are being seen here in Oregon?
There are a number of changes that you can see. Now, I actually lived for almost 20 years on the Oregon coast in the Halem, and I actually saw and have some photographic evidence that there's been a slight rise in sea level and slightly stronger storms. There's been a little more erosion there. The big changes that I've seen in my time since I began coming to Oregon, which was in the 70s and then settled here, is the level of glaciers on the mountains. I have a pair of pictures in my book of a photograph I made of Mount Hood in 1984. At what was then the end of the season, late August, it would frequently start snowing again up at the top of the mountain in September. And I remade that picture in both 2002 and 2006 and from the same viewpoint. And that not only is this end of the season much later, it doesn't start snowing usually until a month or two later than that now, but you can visibly see that the ends of the glaciers have pulled up the mountain, are shorter than they were in my picture from 1984. So that short period of time, you can visibly see a change in glaciers, and there certainly are fewer large snowfields up there. And this is confirmed by the studies that people at Portland State University, Andrew Fountain and other glaciologists have actually been physically measuring the glaciers on Mount Hood. And overall, it's lost about 40% of its ice through the 20th century.
Which is worrying because that's where our water comes from.
Well, that's correct. Living on the west side of the mountains, there's a lot of rain, and summertime drought is not as severe a worry, although it could be. But the big change in Oregon and throughout the Cascades is going to be the water that flows to the east and the water that flows into the salmon streams. Not only is this flow starting to happen earlier in the season, but it peaks earlier and is going to start dropping off later in the summer. So there's going to be probably a severe water shortage in certain places because of this not only change in how snow falls in the mountains, but also the fact that the glaciers are getting smaller and eventually will have less water to put out during the dry time of the year when the water is really relied on. And there are people around the world who, unlike most Americans, live way up and right at the glaciers, the people in the Andes and in the Himalayas and the more advanced societies in the Alps have been living right near the glaciers for hundreds of years, and they face a severe problem almost immediately because they get almost all of their late season or dry time water from the glaciers. And there are communities there that will start feeling the pinch very soon because there are small glaciers that are already dried up to just little snowfields now in the Andes that I've seen. And there are villages right below that are dependent on that water. So this is actually one of the largest effects of climate change, is a change and a shortage of fresh water for millions, if not billions, of people.
Well, which is one thing that it seems kind of confusing because I would have thought that as things are melting, that we would see more rain. Like, where is this water going?
Well, first of all, the water that's melting from glaciers is going into the ocean, which is contributing to sea level rise. The what's happening with the atmosphere is very complex, and I don't claim to understand it fully.
Right, you're the photographer, not the scientist.
But I've talked to scientists and tried to understand this. Basically, what happens with the water cycle in the atmosphere when the atmosphere warms is that it gets less stable and the extremes on both ends begin to get more extreme. More moisture, more warmth in the atmosphere means it can hold more moisture, which means there's more water available, but it also means that that water is likely to fall in more intense periods. So what happens is, even though rainfall may not increase very much, in fact, I think it's only something like 2 or 3% increase over the United States, for example, in the last 25 years or so, increase in total rainfall. But what happens is the storms tend to be much more intense, so you get these deluges that are much heavier than before, which causes more flooding. Flooding, which is one of the main problems that they have with weather events in Europe, is actually increasing quite rapidly. Not so much that there's more rain, there is more water in the rivers while the glaciers are still large and are putting out a great deal of water. But then you have these deluges that are much heavier than they're used to, and historically large floods result. So the whole system is getting a little more intense. It's not necessarily changing across the board. The idea of global warming is a phrase that I use because everybody recognizes, but really it's perhaps global intensification is a better way to put it.
So, for example, you had some articles on the storms in New Orleans, and it seems pretty clear that was caused by climate change, the intensity of the storms and the number of storms that they're seeing in that area.
There's actually two parts to that, and it does appear to be, to most scientists studying these storms, and again, a hurricane is a very complex storm, it does appear that the fact that the air is warmer and the ocean is warmer, that these storms are getting somewhat more intense as they develop. Hurricane Katrina, when it came across Florida first, was only about a Category 1 and or beginning to be a 2, but within just a couple days of back over the warm Gulf waters again, it got to be a 5. It intensified very rapidly because of the intense heat that was in the ocean that year. But by the time it hit New Orleans, it was back down to a strong 3. It was not really an unusually strong storm when it hit New Orleans. What was unusual about New Orleans, and will be the norm, I think, for storms hitting big metropolitan areas, which will happen more frequently now, is that the social system was also under stress. The physical system was under stress. Issues of race and money and politics came to play. And I think what I say basically is it's a question about whether there will be more hurricanes. Probably not more hurricanes. It's not measured as having more hurricanes, but they're likely to be stronger. And the fact that so much more of the coastal landscape is under risk now because the ocean is higher means that there will be more people affected by any given storm. And I expect better from our government. But I think we're going to see huge failures in how we deal with people, how we rescue people, how people can get out of the way of storms. When Miami is hit by a huge hurricane, or if New York City is, both very likely, we're going to have many more people that we have to rescue and evacuate. And there's a real question about whether our systems are up to that challenge. And around the world, all the cities that are on the coastline are going to face this possibility of higher tide, bigger storm, and then a lot more people living in cities than they're ready to rescue. It's a very difficult concept that involves all of our social systems and all of our military and our police systems. It's a very complex mix when you have a huge storm in a big city.
Well, one of the things that surprised me too is you had some statistics about the number of people who actually live in coastal areas and the number of people moving to them. And it seems like there's a lot of people moving to coastal areas.
People like, especially Florida. Florida counties are among the fastest growing counties in the entire United States. Thousands of people move to Florida every day, and they like it there. It's warm. It's pleasant. Housing is available. But, yeah, this means that more people are at risk. There is over 300 million people live within a meter of sea level. And a meter sea level rise is the outside of the prediction that is expected, that they're expecting to see in this century. The Intergovernmental Panel, the IPCC, the famous UN group that's actually putting out a final report this weekend, their top guess was something over 2 feet, but almost every scientist that I talked to who was studying glaciers or sea level rise directly thought that that was very low, again, because of the speed in which things were changing.
So it looks like a tremendous number of people could be affected fairly quickly by this rise in sea level.
I mean, if you think 100 years is is rapid, and in some respects, in terms of redeveloping a huge city, it is quite rapid. Things will happen before that, though. I think we'll see moments when, as I mentioned, when there will be a particularly high tide that's higher than normal because the sea level is an inch higher. And an inch on the sea means that on a flat, sandy soil in a city that's built in an estuary means the water comes in much farther than an inch, comes in many, many feet. So you will see moments when there's a strong storm and higher tides combining, and it'll cause much more damage, much more flooding than people are used to, than the normal storm would create. And that's what we're really concerned about. And that's likely to be seen almost at any time in Florida or in Ho Chi Minh City or Shanghai, or even, as I said, in New York City, which does get these intense storms that are hurricane-like that come up the East Coast.
Right. And it's not just people that are being affected by this climate change. You have pictures in your book of the first species that's been documented as becoming extinct because of climate change. Can you tell us a little bit more about what happened to the golden toad and what this means for other animals on the planet?
Actually, I wish I did have pictures of the golden toad.
Oh, that wasn't that toad?
I have a picture of another toad in the tropics that has not been seen for some time. The golden toad is the famous one because it was one of the treasures of Monteverde, which is a rainforest preserve in Costa Rica. I think probably many people who have traveled to Costa Rica on vacation have probably gone there. It's an incredible place. It is a cloud forest, so that's foggy with these incredible tropical trees. And there are lots of microhabitats. And so, yes, there was a particular toad that was brilliantly orange, and it was last seen about 10 years ago now and has not been seen since. They go there every year. I went out with a scientist, in fact, on one of his yearly searches in the places where the frog used to be found, to see if there are any remaining, and it has not been seen. Nobody knows for sure when to draw the line and claim that an animal is extinct, because there may be a place where they're surviving, of course, which would be great. But it hasn't been seen, and at the same time, there have been herpetologists all over the tropics noticing failures in certain kinds of, especially cloud forest frogs and toads, and there are something like 50 species of frogs and toads and other amphibians in the North American and South American tropics that also are declining very rapidly, are not found where they normally have been found, and may also be on their way out. And they think this is not just a straight one-to-one ratio, that is, it's getting too dry, and so they're drying up. It's more of the kind of synergistic effect, which is going to be very powerful in terms of all that's happening with the climate, and that is that the change in climate, which is warmer and drier in some places, tends to favor a particular fungus that is fatal to these amphibians. And again, this is not a direct one-to-one relationship. Scientists are very careful about trying to draw conclusions from data that has disparities in it, and this does. But they now believe that looking at all these different frogs and toads, that the climate change is the key factor that caused this fungus to get stronger, not to die out during the dry times, and to attack and kill more of these amphibians.
And then the large mammals are being affected too, because a lot of the preserves are in one spot, but as the climate changes, where they can live changes, but the borders of those reserves don't change.
This is the pulling the tablecloth out from underneath the dishes effect that I see. And it's actually very, very little talked about at this point. Most of our national parks are in a particular place because it was politically possible to draw a line at a certain place. That's why they're so often squares,
right,
rather than being in an ecological shape of the watershed. And it is true, especially in coastal national parks like Everglades, but also in the mountain national parks like Glacier National Park and up in the Arctic, where the climate is literally, the habitats are literally moving north or moving up the mountainside. And there, of course, if that particular mountain is not protected, or if what's in the next valley has already been given over to a city or a factory or something like that, the animals and plants may attempt to migrate to stay in the habitat that they evolved in, but they may find that they can't, there's no habitat there when they move. And so we're going to see a fragmentation of the normal habitats in many national parks, the habitats that we treasure. In this part of the world, we're going to see the warming and the drying in the summers are likely to affect the forests, and we might possibly have more forest fires. And
yeah,
even in the Midwest, the life zones, the what they're called the hardiness zones, where plants are like what gardeners use to learn what kind of plant will survive. It's based on how often it freezes in the winter. Those zones have moved up as far as many as 200 miles in Alabama and Missouri and Nebraska just since 1990. So even though the changes are not as dramatic in the middle part of the United States, we definitely see this movement of life zones going north is beginning to happen.
Well, I've been speaking with Gary Brosh. His book, Earth Under Fire, How Global Warming is Changing the World, documents the climate changes. And, you know, I think this would be a great book to give to your relatives this Christmas who keep saying, that global warming stuff isn't really real, because this is, it documents it. It's a beautiful book to look at, and it just documents everything that's going on so well. So
I just wanted to say that what your relatives, when they read the book, will get also at the end of the book is a lot about what we can do about this. This is not like it's not like our fate to go down with the world here in global warming. We have a lot of technology available. We have a lot of things, especially efficiency. We waste so much of our energy. So there's much we can do to keep it from getting to the worst kind of scenarios that the scientists are worried about.
Okay. Gary, thanks a lot for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you.
On Saturday, November 17th, Portland Commissioner Sam Adams will host the second annual Junk to Funk Recycled Fashion Show contest at the Wonder Ballroom in Northeast Portland. The contest will feature 26 pieces of wearable art and fashion made out of found objects, recycled materials, and things you might normally find in the trash, with local luminaries as judges. The show will also feature Do Jump Dance Theater, The Golden Greats, DJ Anjali and the Incredible Kid, and a DIY craft table provided by Scrap. Junk to Funk is in collaboration with Orlo, a nonprofit that uses arts to explore and bring awareness to environmental issues, and KABU is proud to be a co-sponsor. The event is on November 17 at Wonder Ballroom, 128 Northeast Russell. Doors open at 7:30, show begins at 8:30. More information is available at www.junktofunk.org or junktofunk@gmail.com.
It's somewhere very near 10 o'clock, and coming up next is DIY Portland. Julie Sabatier hosts a show about home funerals and green burials with guests Patricia Sweeney of Spiral Life in Home Wakes and Funerals and Cynthia Beal of the Natural Burial Company. Stay tuned for that, and also for Art Focus, which comes up after that. She's got local artist, curator, and critic Jeff Yon, and at 10:30, Democracy Now! Stay tuned.